The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic, and also we'll be taking a look at an article written for the Washington Post and also published by the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we visit ghost forests that include locations in North Carolina as well as many other states. The article is written by Joel K. Bourne, Jr. and appeared in the September 2023 issue of National Geographic. At the beginning is a two-page photo of a large lake in central Florida with battered but unbowed bald cypresses, or unbowed, I should say, bald cypresses that guard the lake shore. The photo caption continues, and I read, "The storms that deformed them likely saved them from the logger's saw. Just a small fraction of North America's ancient cypress forest remain." Under the title Ghost Trees, the editors write, "Bald cypress trees have stood as sentinels over thousands of years of history. Now they're teaching us something about our future." So let's see what they're going to teach us as we continue. On a brisk December day, David Stahl stands atop a ladder, leaning against a bald cypress tree as wide as he is tall. Like a woodsy Doctor Who dropped into this southern swamp with a sonic screwdriver, Stahl begins slowly boring through time. The first inch takes him back to before the First World War, the second to the birth of the United States. Within 5 inches, Stahl, a dendrochronologist at the University of Arkansas, has reached Columbus's voyage to the New World. By the time he's finished extracting the pencil-thin core, Stahl has enough rings of estimate that the gnarled cypress sprang from its sodden bed as the first crusaders were marching toward Jerusalem about 1,000 years ago. But it's the half-inch sliver close to the bark from around 1900 to 1935 that Stahl points out. By the end of that period, roughly 90% of the ancient bald cypresses in the U.S. had been cut, Stahl says. There's less than a tenth of 1% of the original bottomland cypress swamp left in the country. That's why this place is something special. This place is an overlooked patch along North Carolina's Black River that contains the oldest known trees east of the Rockies. In fact, the bald cypress is the fifth oldest known sexually reproducing tree species on the planet. The tree Stahl has just cored is barely middle age. One cypress he discovered here in 2017 dates to at least 605 B.C., not long after Homer regaled the Greeks with the adventures of Odysseus, and that makes it over 2,600 years old. And Stahl has found several others of similar vintage nearby. The data from their cores and from the other bald cypresses in the southeast from one of the longest and most accurate records of soil measure in science. Decades-long droughts, as well as wet periods known as pluvials, are clearly written in their rings down to the exact year. These include a drought that may have doomed England's first foothold in the New World, Sir Walter Raleigh's famous Lost Colony in 1587, and a second one in the 16th century that was even worse. The 20th century is not representative of the extremes these trees have endured, says Stahl, who has cored ancient trees all over the world. A 16th century megadrought extended from Mexico to Canada, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and lasted almost 40 years. We haven't seen anything like that in the modern era, he adds. While these ancient trees provide a window on our climate past, their siblings closer to the coast are teaching us an equally important lesson about our climate future. Even though bald cypresses are among the most resilient trees on Earth, able to withstand some of the worst conditions nature can muster, cypress forests are now dying in droves along the coastline from Delaware to Texas, leaving bone-white skeletons in their wake. These ghost forests are perhaps the clearest signal we have of the inexorable rising tide that is pushing saltwater deep into the once freshwater ecosystems. Although bald cypresses are more salt-tolerant than the ashes, oaks, and other species that share their forested wetland home, they can't survive long with more than 2 parts per thousand salt in their water. And about 2 parts per thousand is a PPT, so that's a shortened version. The Atlantic Ocean can exceed 35 PPT, and the level of the ocean is rising faster along the eastern seaboard than almost anywhere else on the planet. Sea level in nearby Wilmington, North Carolina, our state's largest port, has risen about 12 inches since 1950 and is projected to rise at least another foot by 2050. The Black River trees aren't currently threatened by saltwater. The river remains a quintessential black water system, but farther downstream in the Lower Cape Fear watershed, at least 800 acres of forested wetland have turned into salt marsh since the 1950s, as the water has become more brackish, according to recent research from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Once annual average salinity hits the 2 ppt mark, the conversion from forest to marsh becomes inevitable. Cape Fear's ghost forests, which can be seen from area bridges, are a microcosm of a much larger trend. A recent study by researchers at the University of Virginia and Duke University using satellite imagery found that the Gulf Coast and Atlantic coastal plain lost more than 5,000 square miles, or 8%, of forested coastal wetlands between 1996 and 2016. That's a Connecticut-sized swath of forest that is now mostly salt marsh and scrub. And almost 270 square miles continue to disappear each year, more than triple the loss of rate of global mangroves, long considered one of the most threatened ecosystems on Earth. The researchers concluded that at that pace, barring the widespread protection of restoration efforts, we could lose all our coastal forested wetlands before the century's end. Bald cypress swamps were North America's Amazon 120 years ago, covering an estimated 40 million acres of the serpentine forested wetlands of the South. They were home to magnificent ivory-billed woodpeckers, delicate at Bachman's warblers, and swarms of Carolina parakeets, not to mention a plethora of aquatic species. But protecting swamps has long been a hard sell. In fact, they are perhaps the only ecosystem that has been specifically targeted for destruction by the federal government. The Swampland Act of 1850 and another like it gave unclaimed federal wetlands to several southern states, requiring the proceeds from land sales to be used to drain them. None other than the great orator Daniel Webster summed up the general sentiment in 1851. Nothing beautiful or useful grows in it, and the traveler through it breathes miasma and treads among all things unwholesome and loathsome, he said. Unlike their close cousins, the redwoods and giant sequoias, cypresses had no organization to save the Redwoods League to lobby for their protection. No Ansel Adams, worthy vistas to show the nation what was at stake. As soon as loggers developed cable logging, steam-powered skidders, and other technologies that enabled them to reach into the deep into the swamps, they set upon them like beavers, turning acres of old-growth cypresses into siding, shingles, even banana crates, until only the most isolated pockets of the ancient trees remained. The Carolina parakeets, ivory bills, and the Bachman's warblers eventually vanished as well. On a cool autumn day with no miasma in sight, National Geographic explorer Max Stone, David Stale, and local guide Charles Robbins launched their kayaks into the Black River's labyrinth of channels, flowing with water the color of fine bourbon. Their goal is to visit the 2,000-year-old trees Stale discovered in 2017 and to find and core 36 more denizens that Stone had spotted during an aerial survey of the area known locally as the Three Sisters Swamp. The stillness of the swamp is palpable, broken only by paddle drips and the heart-stopping flush of brightly colored wood ducks. Without Robin's local knowledge, getting lost would be almost instantaneous. Robbins has lived in Wilmington since the 1980s and has seen the ghost forest creeping up the Cape Fear River, hammered by a trifecta of sea level rise, dredging of the ship channel, and frequent hurricanes. They all got beat to hell during Bertha and Fran, Robin says, referring to the two hurricanes that scored direct hits on the Cape Fear region in 1996, causing major flooding and billions of dollars in damages. Many tops were broken off, and they were coated with salt spray. They just started to decline. The water around the Three Sisters is not salty, he says, but it gets hit from heavy nutrient loads upstream in Sampson and Duplin counties, which have the highest density of hogs in the nation and untold numbers of chicken and turkey farms. Nearly all of the waste from millions of hogs, chickens, and turkeys is spread on fields. Mature cypress forests are incredibly good at cleaning up water. Some have even been used to treat municipal sewage in Louisiana. But such high levels of nutrients invite alligator weed, an exotic species, to settle in, and it can outcompete young cypress seedlings. En route to Stone's Trees, the boats are eventually blocked by a flanks of cypress knees, some more than 10 feet tall, so the group abandons the kayaks and sloshes through the boot-sucking muck to the rough GPS location on Stone's map. One key to the oldest tree's survival, Stale believes, is that they have certain gnarl factor that makes them worthless as lumber. The trees they find are no exception. They sport massively swollen and fluted bases festooned with burls the size of kitchen tables. The first tree's top is split and ragged, torn off by some punishing storm and then regrown willy-nilly. The second has a trunk that divides into two 50 feet up, then spirals together like giant flamingos. The last has a hollow that once housed a black bear big enough to scrape its mark 7 feet off the ground. Eastern North Carolina, by the way, has some of the largest black bears in the world. Though he can't core the hollow tree, Steele estimates it is likely as old as the other two, which have lived at least 1,000 years. That's the thing about old trees, says Julie Moore, a retired biologist from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who pointed Steele to the Black River in the early 1980s when she worked for the North Carolina Natural Heritage Program. They wouldn't have lived this long if they couldn't take it. Species that have been with us a long time have to adapt. Many of those adaptations could prove invaluable to humans in a hotter, drier, and stormier world. One study found that even young cypress trees can withstand months of flooding more than 30 feet deep, while their trunks, their knees, and the swampy soils around their roots absorb stormwater and carbon like a sponge. Stale has shown they can survive decades-long droughts, and others have determined that cypresses can contribute to groundwater recharge and even filter some contaminants. Their high salt tolerance often makes them the last of the ghost forest trees to go. But it's an uncanny ability to survive the most powerful storms on the planet that makes them truly unique. William Connor, interviewed for a research job at Clemson University's Bell W. Baruch Institute of Coastal Ecology and Forest Science in Georgetown, South Carolina, 2 weeks after Hurricane Hugo blasted the state in 1989. The Category 4 storm came ashore with winds of nearly 140 miles an hour, damaging some 4.4 million acres of forest and destroying 6.7 billion board feet of saw timber, enough to build about 660,000 homes. That would have housed almost the entire state of West Virginia at the time. When I drove through Francis Marion National Forest, all the pines were flattened to the ground, says Connor, now professor emeritus at the Institute. All the cypresses along the streams were still standing. They are incredibly windfast with their buttresses and knees and intertwined root systems. I've only seen two trees blown over in my career, and both were isolated by themselves. That makes them particularly good for restoration projects in places like Louisiana, which once may have had the greatest cypress forest on the continent. Hurricane Katrina was able to flood 80% of Greater New Orleans in no small part because the city was built on old cypress swamps that were logged and drained, and it eventually sank many feet below sea level. But with several freshwater diversions now in place and the closing of the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet shipping channel, which was a direct conduit for salt water from the Gulf of Mexico into Lake Pontchartrain, the basin of that lake, conservation groups have been steadily planting cypresses to restore the region's lost hurricane buffers, among other benefits. The Pontchartrain Conservancy has planted about 92,000 trees since 2010. We've been getting anywhere from 65 to 98% survival rate, depending on the site, says Michael Hopkins, who runs the Conservancy's planting program. Some of the trees are now 30 to 40 feet tall. When they become mature adults, they can be there for centuries as long as there's enough fresh water, he said. As the shadows lengthen on the Black River, Stale, Robbins, and Stone paddle back toward the Three Sisters Grove to set up camp on a sandbar where a copse of ancient cypresses blots out the stars. After Stale found the first Roman-era trees in the mid-80s, the Nature Conservancy began buying land and conservation easements around the grove. It now owns some 17,000 acres along the Black, including the area around the oldest trees. Stale doesn't think that's enough. A proposal to create a Black River State Park fizzled in 2017 after some local residents expressed concern about the effects of an influx of visitors might have on the old trees and the quiet rural community, even though a statewide survey conducted that year found strong support for state protection. They're at 2 meters of elevation near the coast, so they're threatened by sea level rise, Stale says. At that level, we'll be losing cities, and we can't allow that to happen. But even the small remnant old-growth forest can be at the core area of a broader plan of ecosystem restoration. I'd like to see it protected as a national preserve or monument. He cites the creation of South Carolina's Congaree National Park as an example. One of the year's oldest trees stands 100 feet away, as it has throughout the ravages of the past 2,600 years. Its busted top is sprinkled with resurrection ferns, so named, Stale says, because they can lose nearly all the water in their tissues during drought, turn gray as death, then spring back to life good as new at the first rain. They seem a fitting accessory for this ancient member of a species long known as the wood everlasting, which, with care and conservation, could help us adapt to a warmer, stormier world. What a story there, huh? Well, as you enjoy this fall, I want you to take a moment to reflect on the summer that just passed. Do you recall seeing any fireflies, or as some call them, lightning bugs? Our next article was headlined, "Summer's Here, Where Are the Fireflies?" Now, it was written by Dino Grandoni for the Washington Post and appeared in the July 4, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. A photo caption provides an overview. It shows a firefly display at Grandfather Mountain State Park in Linville, North Carolina. Nearly one in three firefly species in the United States and Canada may be threatened with extinction, firefly experts estimate in a recent comprehensive assessment. Now let's read the article. As a younger man, Joe Cicero saw thousands and thousands of them. Swarms of fireflies put on soundless fireworks show for him every summer in southern Arizona. The sight of the fireflies flashing in unison was so mysterious and mesmerizing, the entomologist made the study of the flickering insects his life's work. For decades later, Cicero, now retired, still goes back to those oak woodlands. Today, though, they're mostly dark. The fireflies have been decimated, Cicero lamented, down to just a trivial few relative to the big population they had back then. The insects go by many names, depending on where you live. Forget what the calendar officially says. For many Americans, their otherworldly glow signals the start of summer. But across the country, many of these harbingers of summer may be blinking out of existence. What was once a series of tales from old-timers about the decline of fireflies from the days of their youth is coalescing into a disturbing scientific truth. Nearly one in three firefly species in the United States and Canada may be threatened with extinction, firefly experts estimate in a recent comprehensive assessment. Surveys abroad show declines from mangroves in Malaysia to grasslands in England. New research is shedding light on how these ethereal insects are struggling to thrive in the brightly lit world we have built around them. And the problem is bigger than a single type of bug. The fireflies are the icons that tell you that the habitat is in trouble, Cicero said. In so many spots where scientists look, insects of all sorts are vanishing, with potentially disastrous results. Populations are plunging in Germany and the Netherlands, in Puerto Rico and the American West, leading to fears of a potential, though still hotly debated, bug apocalypse. which could unravel food webs for birds and other insect-eating animals and cause calamity for farmers who need pollinators to grow crops. I know a lot of people who hate insects. I've never met a single person who didn't like fireflies, said Sarah Lewis, a Tufts University biologist and author of Silent Sparks, The Wondrous World of Fireflies. For her, the firefly is the gateway bug for eliminating the need to protect the rest of the natural world. Next section, titled Plight of the Firefly. To understand the threats to fireflies, you start underground. Fireflies in the United States spend the vast majority of their lives in their larval state, roaming the dirt to consume snails, worms, and other soft-bodied grubs several times their size. In contrast to their gentle summertime image, baby fireflies are vicious predators. But so much of the swampy soil young fireflies need to thrive is increasingly being bulldozed for golf courses, suburban subdivisions, and other types of development, making habitat loss a top threat. In Delaware and Maryland, for instance, the Bethany Beach firefly delights beachgoers, or at least it used to. Today, its sandy habitat is being squeezed by beach home construction on the one side and by sea level rise because of climate change on the other. Now it has nowhere else to go, making it one of the country's most imperiled firefly species. These wetlands only occur right along the beach, along the Mid-Atlantic, said Christopher Hechner, an environmental scientist at Delaware State. So that ends up pushing Bethany Beach firefly right to the top in terms of priority for protection, he says. In Arizona, the southwest synchronous firefly that Cicero studies is being trampled by different threats. Cattle and all-terrain vehicles in Coronado National Forest are stomping out its riverside habitat, he said. It's very damaging. Next section, welcome to the light show. When the time is right in the spring, juvenile fireflies seek a spot to pupate, much like how a caterpillar transforms into a butterfly. A young butterfly rearranges its body, or firefly, I should say, rearranges its body to turn into an adult, and then they make flight. The adult lives for only a few weeks, with one thing on their minds. Fireflies flicker at each other to find their mates. The spectacle is, in fact, one big bug orgy. Some fireflies start the sexual pyrotechnics at dusk. Others wait until midnight to turn on the lights. Some wink at each other with a double flash, others a triple. Males of certain species work together to woo mates by synchronizing their pulses. Other varieties are more ruthless, imitating the flashes of smaller fireflies to lure them in and eat them. There are more than 2,000 species of fireflies globally, each doing a different dance. Even in the best conditions, males drifting in the air struggle to find females on the ground. Mating success rate in darkness is not especially high, said Avalon Owens, a research fellow at Harvard. I have no idea how we will still have fireflies when they're so bad at this. So many things can go wrong. Increasingly, we're the ones making it harder. The artificial light we pour into the night is interrupting these bioluminescent courtships. To test the impact of light pollution, Owen set up a mating area on her porch and home outside Boston in 2020 during the height of the coronavirus pandemic. Our landlord didn't insulate it, which was perfect, said Owens, at the time a PhD student under Lewis, so it's just exposed to the elements, and I just kept the window open the whole summer. In a study published last year, Owens and Lewis found exposing a semi-nocturnal firefly species called Photinus obscurellus to a bright light on the porch completely prevented it from mating. Out in the wild, the pair found males of related species, P. greeni, preferred LEDs meant to imitate females that were bathed in darkness. Brightening the night not only makes it harder for fireflies to see each other, it may also trick them into thinking it's daytime, Owen said. It erases their habitat, she added. It gets rid of places where they can be. Turn off the light. Well, not every type of firefly is in peril. Some are actually thriving in our well-lit world. The Big Dipper firefly, named for the swooping arc it draws in the sky, evolved to come out at dusk and does not seem to mind modern streetlights. In their field experiments, Owens and Lewis found artificial lighting had little impact on the Big Dipper's mating. Plenty can be found in its well-lit corners of Central Park in New York. For many fireflies, there is a painful lack of data on even baseline populations. While some species remain abundant, overall, we risk the loss of firefly biodiversity. Despite the threats, no firefly species is protected under the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering petitions to safeguard five species, including the Bethany Beach firefly. While reversing climate change and other environmental threats is monumentally difficult, saving fireflies from their light pollution is relatively easy. You can literally just turn off the light and the threat is gone, said Candace Fallon, a senior conservation biologist, with the Xerces Society, a nonprofit conservation group pressing the federal government to extend endangered species protections to fireflies. We may owe it to them to flip the switch. Fireflies provide us with much more than twinkling. Scientists have deployed the bioluminescent chemicals harbored in their lanterns to detect food contamination, develop new antibiotics, and test chemotherapies for treating cancer. For now, fireflies aficionados are trying to inspire the next generation. Nearly 30,000 people flock to the Great Smoky Mountains each year to watch the park's fireflies light up and sink. In Arizona, Cicero stages similar night watch parties for the few synchronous fireflies that remain there. The whole thing is for kids, Cicero said. Tell you the truth, they're the investment that we have in the future of these species. And the article concludes with some tips on how you can protect fireflies. It says, let the grass grow, leaving parts of your lawn unmowed, and the leaf litter helps the ground retain moisture, creating a better habitat for the firefly larva. Then you can minimize lights at night to reduce the light pollution. Only turn on an outdoor lighting when you're using it, and consider installing lights with motion sensors and timers. So some good information there about the disappearing population of fireflies. Well, before we head out from today's journey, let's take a look at some things we can do. And this comes from the September-October edition of AAA Living, and it's their due dates section. We have coming up on October the 28th the Lexington Barbecue Festival. Now, this celebrate Lexington-style barbecue at this one-day feast of fest. You can dine on cue from some of the best pitmasters around, check out sand sculptures, and then pay a visit to the classic car show, take in the juried arts and craft show, and enjoy a concert before calling it a day. Now, if you want more information on all this, you can go to online to barbecuefestival.com, thebarbecuefestival.com. And October the 28th and 29th, we have the North Carolina Festival by the Sea. This is a parade across the Holden Beach Causeway kicks off the festival. It's full of coastal arts and crafts, and there's plenty of kids' activities, food vendors, and musical acts keeping things lively, while dozens of artisans and craftspeople sell their wares. For more information about this, you go to ncbrunswick.com and then /events/annual-events/festival-by-the-C. Once again, ncbrunswick.com/events/annual-events/festival-by-the-C. So that should be a lot of fun. North Carolina Festival by the Sea brings us to the end of today's Journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The reading site service again is ncreadingservice.org, and if you prefer, you may make comments or questions to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.